Revelation before lunch. The 17th century was a fascinating and interesting time, politically, sociologically, ecclesiastically, and theologically, and in particular, eschatologically. One man of this time answered Nullus, which I will call him because that's what I'm used to, the way of, I've got in the notes, which will be in the written copy, has about 8 different ways it was spelled, some even by himself in this period of time. So we're not quite sure how he pronounced it, but I'm going to pronounce it Nullus or Nullies. Nullus wrote 6 books over a 30-year period addressing the subject of the second coming of Christ. What is interesting about Nullus's work is not that he wrote on the subject, for many learned men were writing on it, but that all of his eschatological works were written during the Restoration period, the last third of his life. Most of the important English eschatological works were written before the interregnum by such men as John Napier, Thomas Brightman, Arthur Dent, Joseph Meade, Thomas Goodwin, Nathaniel Holmes, and John Archer, to name a few. During the Revolution period, there was a ballooning of eschatological works because the end-time predictions of men like Meade appeared to be coming true. In addition, Nullus's work is not only interesting for its timing in history, but its timing, as we said earlier, in his life. These 6 works only began to be published when he was 69 years of age. From these facts, certain questions concerning Nullus's eschatology emerge. For example, why did he not publish his eschatological views earlier in life? And why did he not publish them during, really, the height of the 1640s and 50s eschatological frenzy? And again, why did he only begin to publish and continue to publish during the Restoration period? These are interesting questions that beg for answers, but fall beyond the scope of this paper. Once again, in the footnotes, I will give some answers to this. This paper, however, will primarily be a descriptive study of Nullus's eschatology with a special focus on his exposition of the book of Revelation. And from it, we will draw some lessons for the church today. This analysis of Nullus's eschatology will fall into 2 parts. The first will be to outline his eschatology using his 6 eschatological works, but with special reference to his exposition of Revelation. The second part will be to examine the purpose, outline, and method of interpretation of his exposition of Revelation, making some final observations. But before we enter into this analysis, we will briefly outline Nullus's life and work in order to supply a context for our study of his eschatology, a rather interesting life that spanned most of the 17th century. Hansard Nullus began as a member of the Church of England, became an independent, and finally, a particular Baptist. In addition, he was a little bit unusual for Baptists in that he was an educated pastor and one of the leaders of the particular Baptist Association of Churches throughout its first 50 years of existence. Moreover, he had traveled beyond the borders of England, spending 4 years in New England and some other time on the continent. He is therefore an interesting and important figure of early Baptist history. Hansard Nullus was born at Cockwell near Louth in Lincolnshire, England, about the year 1599. Recently, Dr. Buston, in his book, Paradox and Perseverance, argues that that was the dating for his birth is actually later, 10 years later, in 1609. And he makes some very strong circumstantial evidential arguments for that. The thing that keeps bugging me is still William Kiffin, who knew him for 54 years, wrote in his, that is, in the autobiography of Hanser Knowles, which ended up being, I think, 72 when he ended it, that Kiffin finished it after Knowles had died. And he writes that he was in his 93rd year. Kiffin knew him for 54 years. I would think that he would know how old he was and not be off by 10 years. But this still remains a debate. His father, Richard Knowles, was probably the resident clergyman of the parish, a God-fearing man of the Church of England. At the age of 10, Hansard was tutored at home and later briefly attended Grimsby Free School. When he was 14 years old, his father was appointed the Church of England rector of Scartho near Market Grimsby. Consequently, the family moved to Scartho, only a short distance from Cockwell. Sometime afterwards, he studied at Puritan Cambridge, and in particular, St. Catherine's Hall College, where such Puritans as William Strong, John Arrowsmith, and Thomas Goodwin, contemporaries, also attended. On March 30th, 1629, he became a pensioner at St. Catherine's Hall, Cambridge, with a view to ordination in the Church of England. During his time at St. Catherine's, he was under the mastership of the Puritan, well-known Puritan, Richard Sibbes. After only 3 months, Knowles was ordained a deacon and the following day ordained presbyter of the Church of England by the Bishop of Peterborough, Dr. Dove. 2 years later, on August 24th, the Bishop of Lincoln, John Williams, gave Knowles a small living at Humberstone near his father's parish in Scartho. In 1631, Knowles married Anne Cheney, a woman who was 10 years younger than himself, if we take the dating correctly. Daughter of John Cheney, Esquire of Bennington, Knowles tells us she was a holy and discreet woman and a meet help for me in the ways of her household and also in the way of holiness. Shortly after his marriage, Knowles became convinced that some of the practices of the Church of England, including the wearing of the surplice, the signing of the cross in baptism, and the admitting of wicked persons to the Lord's table, were sinful. Consequently, he resigned his living sometime after March 1633, but was permitted for several years to continue to preach. About 1635, or 1636, he became convinced that his ordination was false and that he had not received, quote, any seal from Christ of his ministry. For though many had been reformed and moralized, yet he knew not that he had been instrumental to convert any souls to God, unquote. He resolved not to preach any more until he had clear call and commission from Christ to preach the gospel. Consequently, he began to pray day and night for several weeks, asking, quote, that Christ would count me worthy and put me into the ministry, unquote. One day after praying in the woods at Anderby in Lincolnshire, his prayers were answered while he was walking and meditating, not hearing any voice nor seeing any vision, but only those words which were, quote, plainly and articulately spoken, unquote, into his ears and understanding. Knowles was told to go to Mr. Wheelwright, and he shall tell thee and show thee how to glorify God in the ministry, unquote. The next morning, he went to see Wheelwright, who, unbeknown to Knowles, had just moved into a village 3 miles from Humberstone. He told Wheelwright of his case and that the Lord had sent him. After some conversation together, Wheelwright told Knowles that the latter, that is, Knowles, could not glorify God in the ministry because he was building his, quote, soul upon a covenant of works and was a stranger to the covenant of grace, unquote. Wheelwright then explained to him the covenant of free grace. Upon hearing this, Knowles tells us he considered himself a stranger to free grace in great measure, having been only under legal convictions and a spirit of bondage. He went on to confess, and though I had some discoveries of my want of Christ, yet I had sought righteousness, as it were, by the works of the law and got my peace by performing duties and rested on them. Nollis then went home, and he prayed and, quote, begged of God to teach him the covenant of grace, unquote. He searched the scriptures, and during this period, he heard a message by a Mr. Howe, likely Samuel Howe. On Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, he came to understand that he had lived, quote, a life of works, not of faith. Now he began to see the necessity of believing in Christ for pardon and salvation. Dr. Howe had explained that Christ was the author, the root, and only foundation of saving faith, and that God did give this faith of evidence from Hebrews 11, verse 1, in some new covenant promise, Galatians 3:14, and that those promises were given of God, 2 Peter 1:4. For that night and the next day, Nollis prayed that God would give him such a promise. The following day, he locked himself in the church, and while he was praying, quote, mourning and bemoaning himself, unquote, and his soul's condition, fearing, quote, that God would leave him and forsake him, he was given the promise, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. He then confessed, Lord, who am I? I am a vile, sinful sinner, the chief of sinners, most unworthy of pardon and salvation. How, Lord, never leave thee nor forsake thee? O infinite mercy, O free grace, who am I? I have been a graceless soul, a formal professor, a legal performer of holy duties, and have gone about to establish mine own righteousness, which I now see is but filthy rags. Then God gave him two promises from Isaiah 43 and Isaiah 54, assuring him of the forgiveness of his sins and of his place in the covenant of peace. He records that he experienced joy and peace in believing. The next day he saw Wheelwright, who told him he was now somewhat prepared to preach Jesus Christ and the gospel of free grace to others, having been taught it of God. He instructed Nollis to wait upon God and the Holy Spirit through the Word would teach him how to preach. Nollis went home and began to pray for this. One day while he was praying, these words were spoken to him by the Spirit. I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and a witness, both of those things which thou hast seen and of those things in which I will appear unto thee. Quote from Acts 16. Upon hearing these words from the Lord, he felt called and commissioned to preach the gospel. For the next 3 or 4 years, Nollis experienced the blessing of the Lord on his preaching. And notice the difference between his preaching before and now, in his own words, whereby very many sinners were converted and many believers were established in the faith. Conversion seems to be a key for him that he was actually called. In 1633, the situation worsened, as many of you know, for the Puritans in England, with the elevation of William Laud to the Archbishopric of Canterbury. Laud aggressively pursued a policy of uniformity of worship for all citizens. He left no room for dissent and persecuted those who rebelled. This policy had its effect upon the newly converted Puritan, Hansard Nollis. While he was preaching in Lincolnshire in 1636, he was arrested. Arrested on a warrant from the Court of High Commission. However, he convinced the man who issued the warrant to let him go, and he did. Nollis and his family then went to London for a time, and from there they set off for Boston, Massachusetts on a 12-week voyage, during which they suffered much hardship, including the loss of their only child. They probably reached Boston in the summer of 1638 and remained there, returning to London on December 24, 1641, in the midst of the struggle between King and Parliament that shortly led to the Civil War the following year. It was around this time that the London Particular Baptist group of churches was forming, as we have already been hearing. Between the years 1638 and 1644, 7 churches joined together to form a fellowship of Calvinistic Baptist churches. And in 1644, they declared their orthodoxy and Baptist convictions in a confession of faith known as the London Confession of Faith, or in later times, the First London Confession. About this time, Knollys came to Baptist convictions and joined this young group of churches as one of its pastors. Sometime after this, or his return to London, Knollys became a member of Henry Jesse's independent congregation, so we're talking around 1641-42. It was during this time that Knollys began seriously to question infant baptism and considered that only believers were the proper recipients of this ordinance. In January 43-44, he told Henry Jesse that he was not prepared to have his child baptized and requested that some meeting take place that, quote, they, the church, might satisfy him or he rectify them, if amiss herein, unquote. The discussions were carried on for 2 months, at which time 16 members felt it was wrong to have their infants baptized and had removed themselves, not satisfied we were baptized as a true church. Knollys eventually set up his own congregation. In 1645, they met next door to Great St. Helen's Church, where it was reported by some neighbors that as many as 1,000 attended his services. We're not sure if that's just pure exaggeration or what. He was eventually turned out there by his landlord and moved to Finsbury Fields. In 1646, Knollys did not, in 1644, sign the First London Confession of Faith, though he was there around at that time. He did sign the second edition in 1646, and this second edition contained a few changes that were based on the criticisms by the Presbyterian Daniel Featley. In the 1640s and 1650s, the particular Baptists were to experience tremendous growth as they spread their message beyond London. And Knollys was quite involved in this expansion. For example, in 1649, Kiffin and Knollys were authorized by Parliament to go to Ipswich to preach. And in the early 1650s, he went to Wales as an evangelist, probably appointed by the London churches. Now, it was during the 60s that he published the first of his 6 eschatological works, that is, during the Restoration period, with the return of Charles II on the throne. This first book, written in 1667, was titled Apocalyptical Mysteries, and in it he expounded the historicist view of the book of Revelation in 3 parts, discussing the 7 trumpets, the 7 vials, and the kingdom of Christ to come. We know very little more of Knollys' activities in the 1670s. During the early 1670s, his wife, 1 grandchild, 3 sons, and possibly another grandchild and a daughter-in-law all died. Moreover, he thought he was about to die as well. However, he believed the Lord could heal him, and so he called his friend Kiffin and another Baptist, Vavasor Powell, to pray over him and anoint him with oil, according to James chapter 5, 14 and 15. As a result of this and the prayers of others, he recovered. His wife, during this period of time, however, did not, and she died in 1671. In her 63rd year, after 40 years of marriage. In 1674, Knollys wrote his second eschatological work, The Parable of the Kingdom of God Expounded. In it, he sought to encourage Christian professors and sinners to be ready for the coming of the Lord, which he believed was to be very soon. In this work, he also clearly taught a post-millennial eschatology where Christ will come at the beginning of the millennium spiritually and powerfully, and at the end of the millennium physically and personally. 5 years later, after the popish plot scare, he published 2 more eschatological works, Mystical Babylon Unveiled and an exposition of the 11th chapter of Revelation. Both of these works boldly taught that papal Rome was the great enemy of God's people. At the end of the former treatise, he calls people to come out of papal Rome, and in the latter, he states that he believes the end will occur around 1688, 9 years from the time of this writing. In addition to the above works of the 1670s, Knollys and the London Particular Baptist Churches anonymously published a new confession of faith in 1677. It was made public in 1689 when William and Mary came to the throne and a measure of toleration came to dissenters under the Act of Toleration. At that time, that is in 1689, Knollys, with 36 others, signed this confession, now known as the Second London Confession of Faith. It was a revision, as many of you know, of the Westminster Confession and Savoy Declaration. In 1689, Kiffin and Knollys were the only particular Baptists who had been a part of the movement in its early years and signatories to this confession, and they were the only two to sign both the First and Second London Confessions. In 1681, Knollys wrote his fifth eschatological work, The World That Now Is and The World That Is to Come. This treatise is divided into two parts dealing with the two comings of Christ. The first part teaches that the first coming of Christ was to save sinners, to build up the church of God, and to institute the gospel ordinances for his people to worship the Lord in spirit and in truth. That's the part that we're presently living in. The second part deals with the millennial kingdom, the second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, and the eternal judgment. In the last years of Knollys' life, the last decade, dissenters in general experienced difficult persecution, particularly from 1682 to 1688. During the spring of 1684, Knollys was imprisoned in Newgate for breaking the Conventicle Act. He was 86 years of age, and he was there for 16 months. 4 years later, Knollys published his last and crowning work on eschatology, his exposition of the Book of Revelation. It was formed from messages that he had preached to his congregation in past years, and in it he also gives an invitation to the people of God to come out of papal Rome, and again suggests the time of the end to be around 1688. Fascinating that he publishes it in 1688 and still says it's happening in 1688. On September 19th, 1691, he died in his 93rd year, and he was buried in Bunhill Fields. Now we'll look at Knollys' eschatology and making a general survey to begin with, using primarily his commentary on Revelation, and then we will examine the purpose, outline, method of interpretation of his exposition. First of all, the general survey. Knollys, like most preachers of his time, believed that Christ's second coming was soon, and that the book of Revelation should be interpreted in an historical manner. The 1260 prophetic days, which signify 1260 years of our time, were almost at an end. These days began between 407 and 428 AD. He leans towards the 428 position. And this was when the beast arose out of the bottomless pit and the beginning of mystical Babylon, which for Knollys is clearly papal Rome. This beast, according to Knollys, was the beast of the eighth head, the popes of Rome. The pope is the man of sin, the Antichrist, who became universal bishop and head of the church in 428 AD. Though he was not pronounced as such until 607 AD by Emperor Phocas when he gave this to Boniface III. Later, the Pope obtained temporal sovereignty in the days of Henry V, which is the 14th and 15th century. According to Knollys, the Church of Rome is the great whore because it leads people into spiritual adultery with its false worship and idolatry, and the Roman priests are the false prophet because of the false doctrines they teach and believe. During the 1260-year period that Revelation speaks of, where papal Rome is ruling, the two witnesses of Revelation chapter 11 are prophesying. And these two witnesses are the ministers and the saints of Christ. That is the true church of God. In these days, the two witnesses are to preach true doctrine, worship, and to proclaim Jesus as king. In addition, they are to preach against papal Rome and its false teachings, its false worship, and its exaltation of the pope. Their preaching will continue until the gospel is preached in all the world. Again, during these 1260 years, The woman clothed with the sun and travailing in childbirth, Revelation chapter 12, flees into the wilderness. This woman signifies the true church of Jesus Christ. And in these days, the true church is persecuted by papal Rome. This persecution prior to the 17th century had been experienced by the true church, represented by the Waldensians, the Wycliffeites, the Hussites, and Lollards, and was now being experienced presently by the church that Knollys was a part of in England during the Restoration. That is the Congregational Church. Knollys believed the beast would rage more fiercely at the end of the 1260 days and make war against the witnesses because the witnesses' opposition would be more open and visible at this time. According to Knollys, this raging of the beast had already been fulfilled in the past and was presently continuing and being fulfilled in his day. This war, this raging had been experienced in the Reformation days of Emperor Charles V in the countries of Germany with Luther and France and Scotland and so on. And also in the days of Mary in England when the saints and ministers were persecuted like Latimer and Ridley. And it was being experienced in Knollys' time during the Restoration period as the beast raged against dissenting conventicles. Remember, at this present time, several acts had come in to disallow any of these dissenters to meet together and encouraged only the Church of England worship. Knollys believed when he wrote Apocalyptical Mysteries in 1667 that the end of the 1260 years was near. They were living under the sixth trumpet. In fact, he believed that the end would be in 1688 or thereabouts, when he wrote this first eschatological work. But according to Knollys, before the end of the 1260 years, there must be the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 11's 3.5-year period. At the beginning of this period, the witnesses will be put to death by the beast of Rome. These witnesses will lie dead in the street of the great city of Babylon, which according to Knollys was England and London, of course. Knollys saw a place, special place, for England and London in the plan of God. He believed that later, when the witnesses were raised, the tenth part of the city, represented by England, Scotland, and Ireland, would break away from papal Rome and follow Christ. In other words, once again, England and London in particular have a very special place in the plan of God in the end times. During the 3.5 years, the two witnesses who were dead and who represented the church would be deprived of civil liberty, the exercise of religion, and even life. As a result, the church would be diminished in various ways and become spiritually weak. Knollys believed that during these 3.5 years, there would be great tribulation for all, a great apostasy for the true faith, and the church would be lukewarm and worldly. You see, the witnesses for Knollys is the true church and its ministers. And they will be persecuted. And they will eventually die. Which means for the church that it would be lukewarm and worldly. At the end of the 3.5 years, the witnesses would be raised. And so the testimony of the church restored. Knollys believed that the witnesses had not yet died, and so the 3.5-year period had not yet begun when he published his final eschatological work in 1688, but that it was close to fulfillment. When the witnesses are restored, the seventh trumpet is sounded and the end begins. The seven vials of God's wrath begin to be poured out on mystical Babylon, that is papal Rome, and all those nations who align themselves against Christ. And during the pouring out of these vials, the Islamic Turkish dominion will also be destroyed. And the Jews will return to their land. This is also the time of the Battle of Armageddon, when Christ and his saints will tread on mystical Babylon, the beast and the false prophet, and the kings of the earth who follow the beast. And interestingly, where the Jews defeat the Pope and the Turk, Dr. Buston is going to be dealing with this later. Thus begins the latter-day glory for Nullus. The false prophet and the beast are cast into the lake of fire. The serpent, the devil, is bound for 1,000 years. This is the beginning of the literal 1,000-year reign of Christ with his saints on earth. It is important to note that in most of Nullus's writings, he believed in a spiritual return of Christ at the beginning of the millennium. It takes place after the seventh trumpet and prior to the millennial reign, and it is a virtual, spiritual, powerful, and glorious coming to earth, but not a physical or visible one. Dr. Buston has argued in his recent book that in his final years, particularly in his work, The World That Now Is and The World That Is to Come, and also the exposition of the book of Revelation, that he changed from being a postmillennialist to a premillennialist. I'm not totally convinced. I'm not unconvinced. But we don't have time to be able to look at that right at this moment. But I will be again dealing with it in the footnotes. During the reign of the 1,000 years, Christ is not physically present, but reigns spiritually in and through his saints. In addition, the saints are given perfect bodies. There will be no suffering, sins, persecutions, or pains. And the saints will be kings and priests unto God. During this time, the kingdoms of this world successively become the kingdoms of Christ. Notice that it doesn't all happen at the beginning. It's a carrying on throughout the 1,000 years. And how is it accomplished, this successively the kingdoms becoming the kingdoms of Christ? It is accomplished by the preaching of the gospel during the millennium, by the pouring out of the Spirit during the millennium, and by the breaking to pieces of the kingdoms of this world who oppose Christ. It's a process. In this millennial kingdom of Christ and his saints, spiritual worship takes place in the New Jerusalem, and the nations are converted by it. The kingdom of Christ in the millennium is enlarged by the extraordinary conversion of Jews and Gentiles and by the pouring out of the Spirit on all flesh. Those nations that do submit to Christ and his saints become the kingdom of Christ, but those who do not are destroyed. During this millennium, the saints will be given the dominion and government of the kingdom of Christ, and they will rule by the laws of Christ. They will be qualified for this work by being righteous, being spirited for government, and being clothed with humility, according to Nullus. In addition to being clothed with humility, they will be endued with courage, clad with zeal, and girded with strength and truth, so that they may be able to bind kings in chains and nobles in fetters of iron and execute judgment upon them. The roles have been reversed. Once the kingdom is established and the 1,000 years are over, Satan is loosed and then defeated. Christ returns and appears personally, certainly, suddenly, visibly, and gloriously. The dead will be raised. All people, righteous and wicked, will be judged. And the kingdom of Christ will be handed over to the Father. Then the eternal kingdom will be ushered in. So now that we've hopefully given you an idea of what his eschatology is, very much focusing on what his exposition of the book of Revelation is, I'd like to more particularly in these last minutes look under several heads: purpose, outline, and method. Purpose. Nullus clearly states his purpose for publishing this exposition of the book of Revelation in his epistle to the reader, and he gives two reasons for it. First, he says, those learned and godly men, those past commentators who have exposited Revelation, have improved their fine talents of knowledge and wisdom in their studies and labors published for the benefit of others, in preaching, expounding, and writing their understanding of the revelations of Jesus Christ to his servant John, written in this book, and I dare not hide my talent, knowing that my Lord and Master will shortly call me to give an account of my stewardship. Remember, he's writing this near the end of his sojourn here on earth. The second reason he gives, he says, is that promised blessing of Revelation 1 and verse 3 that did encourage me to read, study, and expound this part of Holy Scripture publicly in the course of my ministry. And now being aged, I have adventured to publish this, my exposition thereof, such as it is, for the benefit of them that shall read it, that they also may be partakers of that blessing. I think what comes through in this second reason very much is his pastoral heart. He has a pastor's heart. He did not write any of his works from speculation, but always with an eye to the church and to God's people in walking with Christ. He instructs and encourages professors of Christ to live a life of godliness and look for the blessed hope of Christ's return and to exhort sinners regarding the day of the coming of the Lord. This is shot through in his various works, particularly his eschatological works. For example, Nollis ended his commentary on Revelation with a call to those in Babylon to come out. Commenting on the words from Revelation 18, verse 1, "Come out of her, my people," he explains, "This call is the call of God our Savior unto all his people in mystical Babylon," papal Rome. "To come out of her, to come out of her, is to separate themselves from the church of Rome, which is now the false church called the great whore and the mother of harlots. Wherefore, come out from among them and be separate, saith the Lord." Nollis pastorally calls believers who are ready for Christ's coming to be watching. And this watching means that the believer be awake, be in continual expectation of Christ's glorious appearance, and be looking out, desirous of, and longing for the coming and kingdom of Christ. And moreover, since Christ was coming soon, Nollis, out of concern not only for the common reader, but also for the rulers of England and London, exhorted the king, the nobles, the judges, and all the magistrates to kiss the Son. Moreover, for Nollis, the truth of the coming of Christ not only called for preparation, but also encouragement for the saints. For the saints, the coming of the Lord gives them great hope. Therefore, according to Nollis, the coming of Christ, which he called this generation truth, ought to be preached for the warning to professors and profane and for encouragement to the saints. Also, with regard to the purpose, not only explicit in the text, but we must remember also the historical context into which Nollis is writing. The time that he publishes is the date of 1688, around which he believes the end will come. That is, the events that inaugurate the millennial reign of Christ. The signs of the time pointed to it. James II was on the throne, pro-Catholic, moving England back to its Catholic roots. The dissenters were under much persecution from 1682 to 88. And James, in 1688, had produced an heir to ensure the Catholic future. The end was very near, and Nollis needed to warn and encourage. Concerning the outline of the book of Revelation, according to Nollis, the book can be divided into three parts or three principal visions. Very simply, the seven candlesticks, Revelation 1 to 3, the seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven vials. And lastly, the new heavens and the new earth. So we divide it up, Revelation 1 to 3, Revelation 6 to 19, and Revelation 20 to 22. The seventh seal contains the seven trumpets and vials, and the seventh trumpet contains the seven vials. This is called, in our day, telescoping of these three visions that make up the bulk of Revelation. Nollis, as many other expositors, see chapter 1 also as significant in verse 19, which outlines the book. The things which are the first three chapters dealing with the historical Asia Minor churches of the time of John's writing during the persecution of Domitian. Chapters 4 to 6 deal with the things which thou hast seen, that is, the condition of the church under the Roman pagan state. And the things which shall be hereafter, given in chapters 7 to 22, refer to the condition of the church under the anti-Christian Roman, Arian, and in particular, papal state. And finally, its victory in the millennial state. Now, concerning the method of interpretation, two things stand out in Nollis's method of interpretation, by no means novel in his time. One was he was a historicist, maintaining that most of the book was to be interpreted historically. And second, he used the figurative symbolic principle of interpretation freely. Concerning the figurative symbolic principle, Nollis agreed with many interpreters of his time. For example, with John Napier, he maintained that the prophetical day of Revelation equaled a year of our time. With Arthur Dent and Thomas Brightman, that the great monarchs and monarchies of this world have been figured forth by wild beasts. With Dent, that the heads and the horns symbolize kinds of government. With Bernard and John Cotton, that the waters and sea symbolize people and nations. And with Joseph Mead, that the woman harlot riding the scarlet beast is the false church of Rome, and that the woman clothed with the sun is the true church. And with Parius, that the angels are the ministers and messengers of truth. His whole commentary is shot through with this principle of interpretation, without really sliding into what we would call a medieval allegory. Concerning the historicist interpretation of the Revelation, he writes this: "The historical matter of this book concerns the state of the Church of God from the days of the Apostle John in the Isle of Patmos, about the year 96, in the reign of Domitian the emperor, unto the end of this world. And therefore I would advise the reader diligently to observe what is already past and fulfilled, what is now fulfilling in our days, and what is hereafter to be fulfilled. And to that end, search the scriptures, read ecclesiastical histories and other expositions of this book together with this exposition. Therefore, the book of Revelation, written by John, dealt with the state of the church from the time of the reign of the Roman Emperor Domitian to the very end of the world. Consequently, the visions of the seals, the trumpets, and the vials should be interpreted historically. According to Nollis, the seven seals contain the judgments of God upon the Roman pagan idolaters, the years prior to Constantine. The trumpets contain the woes of God executed on the Arian apostate persecutors and the papal Rome. And the seven vials contained the last plagues of God's judgment against the Roman anti-Christian papal beast, whore, and false prophet, the time of the destruction of mystical Babylon." Now, just briefly take a closer look at his historicist interpretation of some of the chapters with these various visions. The first principal vision of the seven seals primarily signified the sufferings of God's people under the Roman pagan emperors and the judgment of God on the European empire. This judgment took place through Constantine the Great with the destruction of paganism and the setting up of the worship of Christ throughout the empire. That's the opening of the sixth seal, which brings salvation and judgment. This great day of God's wrath took place in the days of the 10th persecution of the Christians during Diocletian's reign in the beginning of the 4th century. Beginning then in chapter 8 through to chapter 13 is the seventh seal, which begins the sounding of the seven trumpets. But before the trumpets begin in verse 8, there is peace in the church for half the reign of Constantine, 15 years. So we're talking, you know, somewhere around up till the time of Nicaea. After this peace, the great Arian heresy began, in which the Orthodox bishops, ministers, and Christians were persecuted by the Arians. The first angel who sounded the first trumpet represented the faithful ministers of Christ, such as Athanasius and Hilary of Poitiers. And it also included the kings of the Goths and Vandals. This angel sounded against the Roman Empire and Arianism. The second angel represented the faithful ministers of the later 4th century in the Western Church. He sounded the second trumpet concerning the preeminence of the Pope of Rome and the corruption of the worship and ordinances by the clergy. So there is a beginning of this papal Rome surging in the 4th century. And this angel is speaking against it. The third angel represented the ministers of the 5th century, such as Augustine and Jerome, who sounded the third trumpet concerning Nestorius' corruption of worship and teachings. He is the star that fell from heaven in the 5th century. This is also when popery's teachings really are picking up steam. The image of Mary is being held up and walk through the church. False teaching is being taught. There is the idea of extreme unction coming in at this time, and the chancel becoming important for the Lord's Supper, separated from the people and so on. The fourth angel represented Gregory the Great, who opposed John, Bishop of Constantinople, who took the name of Universal Bishop. This took place at the beginning of the 7th century when Phocas gave Boniface III this title of Universal Bishop. It also includes all the faithful ministers who opposed innovations in worship and doctrine. This angel also sounded the fourth trumpet concerning the corruption of the ministers. That is, the church again, of Rome. After this, the three woes against the papal Roman church in mystical Babylon begin. The first woe takes place at the time of the sounding of the fifth trumpet in the 7th century. This trumpet sounds the judgment of God upon the apostates, which include an eminent apostate churchman, the man of sin, and those who follow him. This is the beginning of popedom and of the anti-Christian papal power. Really, he's referring to this Boniface III. An opening of the bottomless pit of idolatry. This anti-Christian papal power will continue for 1,260 years. Now what we've got is this anti-Christian papal power now making its church carry forth in false doctrine and practice. The sixth angel and the second woe now follow. The sixth angel represents the Orthodox ministers who sounded against popish idolatry, image worship, and other superstitions of the Roman clergy. This angel also loosed the four angels of the river Euphrates, interesting, representing the commanders of the armies of the Turkish emperor who will judge the Roman Empire for their idolatrous worship and departure from true worship. Nullus cautiously suggests this takes place for some 390 years. We are told in the 10th chapter that when the seventh angel sounds, two things will happen. The reign of the beast, the whore, the false prophet, and all those kings that follow the beast will come to an end, and the mystery of God will be finished. That is the mystery of God, the conversion of the Jews to Christ and the restoring of the church to its primitive purity of worship and ordinances. The millennial reign begins. Chapter 11 is a recapitulation dealing with the two witnesses, again, about the papal Rome and its response to that, the church. And then also, chapter 13 is, again, focus on the papal Rome as the two beasts are papal Rome, and in particular the Pope, and again, the church's response to that. We move into the chapters 14 through to chapters 19, in which the fifth trumpet, which had sounded earlier, is now explained in greater detail. That fifth trumpet was the judgment to come upon papal Rome. And so we have the harlot described in 17 and the defeat. 18 and then 16, the woes, or pardon me, the vials that begin and so forth. When Nullus comes to the end of chapter 19, we have the Battle of Armageddon, the victory of the church, and the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ with his saints. Chapter 21 gives us a vision of the world to come. That is the world as it is during the 1,000 years on earth. This world to come, according to chapter 21, is the newly created heavens and earth, not something after the millennium, but is the millennium, millennial reign, and where the new Jerusalem, the church in her latter-day glory, is located. The description of the new Jerusalem during these 1,000 years is given in the rest of the chapter and in the first five verses of chapter 22. The rest of the last chapter looks to Christ's second coming, which will be personal, visible, with all his saints, and this will occur at the end of the 1,000 years when Satan is released. Nullus closes his commentary with an invitation to the readers for the present era to come out of papal Rome. Let me just conclude with a few final observations regarding Nullus's interpretation. Number one, what we see so clearly here is a very strong anti-papal rhetoric throughout. This was not something new. This was typical of the time, whether you were you weren't on the fringe to actually believe strongly that the Pope and the Church of Rome was the Antichrist and the false church. You truly believed that the time of the end of the witnesses was on the horizon and the bowls were about to be poured out on papal Rome, although they hadn't begun yet. And the time of tribulation for the church was present. He was experiencing it along with the other churches, the congregational churches in particular in England. And so the church must not lose sight of the fulfillment of prophecy. It's coming. It's about to be here. The wickedness of papal Rome, even the pressing events that are taking place with James II. And so the congregational churches need to be vigilant against papal Rome, and so contend for the truth as congregational churches. Second observation I make is the true church for Nullus is clearly the congregational churches, because they maintain true doctrine, which is reformed, and practice congregational church policy, polity. Thirdly, he believed that the church will always be under persecution. Basically, he had already and had experienced persecution throughout his life as a dissenter. And this persecution always comes from Roman papal church. And fourthly, his works are always a constant call for the true saints to be faithful to the Lord in the midst of whatever they face. And lastly, along with this, hope in the millennial kingdom, where evil will be destroyed and Christ and his saints will reign in holiness and conquer evil. The way it is now, with papal Rome in charge, they will be destroyed and the saints will be on top with Christ. I think there are a few lessons for our generation here that are worth mentioning. One is, Nullus reminds us, maybe we don't agree with a lot of what he says, certainly we don't in certain areas, but he is a reminder to us to keep our eyes on the return of Christ, which we can so easily lose sight of. And secondly, the expectancy of the imminent return of Christ in each generation has been around at least since the Reformation, and is certainly not something new, that there is this idea that Christ could return soon. It is not a new thing for our time, as some people would like to think. And thirdly, a lesson concerning date setting. I don't think I have to tell you, but everyone and his brother, scholar and everyone, were setting dates in the 17th century. And I think in 1948, when Israel came back to the land, people started to think, well, we can now set dates for the time of Christ's return. And so they picked 1988. One guy wrote a book, 88 Reasons the Christ Will Return in 1988. It didn't happen, so he wrote another one in 1989. And it didn't happen too, but and stopped writing. But the point is, date writing is date setting is certainly something people like to do, and it is certainly exciting to do. But we need to refrain from it. And lastly, beware of dogmatism on the interpretation of the book of Revelation. Nullus was certain of his interpretation, his historicist method, his symbolic interpretation in various places, and his pinpointing of the Antichrist. This teaches us to be humble about reading of current events into the text.